Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written for people learning English.
Today, you will hear stories from Faith Perlow and Dan Friedel. Later, Dan Novak will return to present this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Faith Perlow.
The smell of smoke still makes Theolina Maripong afraid. It reminds her of the bomb explosion that changed her life 20 years ago. Maripong was in a car with her co-workers on the Indonesian island of Bali in 2002 when the explosion happened. She was temporarily blinded as pieces of glass went into her eyes. Now 48 years old, Maripong remembers calling out for help and someone bringing her to a sidewalk before health workers arrived. She is one of many Indonesian survivors who were outside of Sari Club on the night of October 12, 2002. That was when a car bombing and a suicide bombing at nearby Paddy's Pub killed 202 people. Most were foreign tourists, including 88 Australians and 7 Americans. 20 years after the Bali bombings, efforts against terrorism in the world's most populous Muslim country remain active. More than 2,300 people have been arrested on terrorism charges since a national counterterrorism unit was created after the attacks. That number comes from the Center for Radicalism and De-radicalization studies. Officials have continued to look for suspects, even as the number of terrorist attacks in Indonesia has fallen. In 2020, 228 people were arrested on terrorism charges. The number rose to 370 last year. But the effort has also raised concerns. Sana Joffrey is the director of the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta. He said the public could start seeing anti-terrorism as something of a political thing, rather than a law enforcement effort. The government is still going after suspects related to the Bali bombings. In December 2020, police arrested 58-year-old Aris Sumarsono, better known as Zulkarnain. The court sentenced him to 15 years in prison for his part in the attack. But in August, Indonesia's government considered releasing the bomb maker in the Bali attack from prison early. His name is Hisham bin Alazain, better known as Umar Petek. Indonesian officials said Petek was an example of successful efforts to reform people found guilty of terrorism. Ni Lu Irniati lost her husband in the Bali bombing. She met Petek at a prison last month. She has also met others who were tried and found guilty of terrorism. She said she believes the meetings can help her heal from the loss of her husband. She told Petek that, because of that incident, I lost my true love. And I told him my life after that. He was crying, really crying, Irniati said. Petek asked for her forgiveness, she said. I held his hand. I said, Yes, I have forgiven you. He was crying louder. Irniety said. I'm Faith Perlow.
Tobacco is one of Turkey's top agricultural products, but some of the country's tobacco farmers say rising operating costs linked to inflation are cutting deeply into their profits. In the tobacco-growing area of Çalıkan, in the country's southeast, farm worker Mehmet Emin Kalkan said people are struggling and don't have much to live on. Kalkan is 19 years old and hopes to go to university to study electronic engineering. But for now, he works in the fields. He told the Associated Press he sometimes works until 9 p.m. Kalkan said he needs to work long days to help his family pay for the books he needs to prepare for the university entrance exam. The man who runs the tobacco farm is İsmail Demir. He said he is not making as much money this year because fertilizer is so costly. Fertilizer is a chemical that helps plants grow. Other costs are high too, such as the diesel fuel he puts into his vehicle to drive to the fields. Last year, he spent about $3 to drive to work. Now it costs about $16 to travel the same distance. The difficulties the farm owner and his worker are experiencing are happening in other industries across Turkey. The country is facing economic problems, driven in part by inflation and weak currency valuations. The Turkish government announced Monday that inflation rose nearly 84% from a year earlier. That is the country's highest increase in 24 years. It is also the highest among the world's 20 largest economies. Independent experts say the country's actual inflation rate is much higher. The Inflation Research Group has estimated the rate is about 186%. The largest increases are costs for transportation, food, and non-alcoholic drinks. Some countries are seeing price increases because of economic slowdowns related to the COVID-19 pandemic and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. But economists who study Turkey say the country's economic problems are mostly linked to financial policy mistakes made by the government. For example, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he believes higher costs for borrowing money leads to higher prices. Most economists, however, believe the opposite is true. But because of the president's pressure, the Turkish Central Bank has lowered the cost of borrowing. When the bank recently lowered the cost of borrowing by 1% to 12%, it weakened Turkey's money, the lira. The currency has lost more than 50% of its value since 2021. Erdogan is up for election in June 2023. He has said his government is centering on measures aimed at increasing exports and driving economic growth. Such policies have already helped save 10 million jobs, the president claims. In a recent speech, Erdogan said, "The interest rate has to go down further." He suggested this will cause inflation to drop as well. The Turkish government has put a number of policies in place to help people deal with inflation. It increased the minimum wage, put in a limit on rent increases, and reduced taxes on energy bills. But even with the policies, people are having trouble keeping up with basic living costs,
also called expenses. Another tobacco grower in Chelicon is Ibrahim Suna. He said he is currently struggling to support his family. Tobacco is our only means of living, and we have no other income, Suna said. He has 5 children. I'm Dan Friedel.
Before a child can read a book, they must know how to read a sentence. Before they can read a sentence, they must know how to read individual words. And before they can read words, they must know letters and learn the alphabet. To be successful at reading or in any subject at school, students must start with learning the most basic knowledge. And many students around the world are not learning these basic skills, also called foundational learning. The problem and possible solutions were recently discussed at the United Nations Transforming Education Summit. Conference attendees said that while the problem already existed before the COVID-19 pandemic, the health crisis made it worse. This is a global learning crisis, said UNICEF Director Catherine Russell. Millions of children are still out of school, and millions of children are in school, but not learning the basic skills. UNICEF found that 2 out of every 3 children around the world cannot read and understand a simple story by age 10. This was a 12% increase since before the pandemic. 3/4 of children by grade 4 also do not have basic math skills. In poorer countries, the numbers are even worse. Just 1 in 10 children in sub-Saharan Africa have basic reading skills by grade 3. Learning poverty fuels economic poverty, Russell said. UNICEF found that long school closures during the pandemic greatly worsened educational inequality around the world. Millions of children left the educational system during the pandemic, and many still have not returned to the classroom. In 2021, UNICEF estimated that 244 million children between the ages of 6 and 18 were out of school. Ibrahim Natatu is the Secretary of Education of Niger. This is not the same situation in developed countries, he told the UN meeting. For us, it's a disaster. Natatu said Niger and other sub-Saharan African countries are currently at war, which adds to the current educational system problems. He said there is also a lack of good teachers. Natatu noted that 57% of primary school teachers in Niger do not have good writing and reading skills, and schools are often in poor condition. Despite these very large global difficulties, leaders see the pandemic as a chance to change education for the better. As a part of the meeting, the UN, World Bank, and other organizations urged governments to take action on the foundational learning crisis. Countries like the U.S., Britain, Sierra Leone, Egypt, and Bulgaria have come together to sign a promise to improve foundational learning. Eleonora Villegas-Ramers is an education expert at Boston University. She said, "We are dealing with the pandemic still, but it's a very, very important opportunity for us to transform education." She added, "Governments around the world have been asked to take a stand and commit to ensure children develop foundational skills." In Niger, Natatu said there has already been some progress. More training and support have been provided to teachers, and officials are working to get computers to all students across the country. Julius Maada Bio is the president of Sierra Leone. He said his country has been able to increase school enrollment by 50% through its free quality education program. He also said more girls and children from poor and rural areas are now attending school. Maada Bio added that schools across the country are now providing children with free warm meals as well. "We owe our children a future of promise, whereas productive citizens, we continue to build inclusive, equitable, and peaceful societies," he said. I'm Dan Novak.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. As president, John Adams was head of the Federalist Party, but the power of that position really belonged to former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. For this and other reasons, Adams did not like Hamilton. He said he would rather be a minister to Europe under Jefferson than a president controlled by Hamilton. Hamilton did not like Adams either. Hamilton did everything he could to block Adams from becoming president again. He gave his support to another Federalist candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Under the electoral system at that time, the candidate with the most votes became president. The candidate with the second highest number of votes became vice president. A Federalist victory in the election of 1800 would not be easy. The Republicans had a very strong and popular candidate in Thomas Jefferson. So Federalist Party leaders attempted to change the electoral system. The Constitution said state legislatures were to choose electors to vote for president. The Federalists tried to gain control over the legislature's decisions. They wanted Congress to create a special committee to rule if an elector had or did not have the right to vote. The committee could say if an elector's vote should be counted or thrown away. The committee would have 6 members from the Senate and 6 members from the House of Representatives. The 13th member would be the Chief Justice of the United States. Creating such a committee violated the Constitution. Federalist leaders knew this, so they wanted Congress to approve the committee, but keep the measure secret until after the election. The Federalists held a majority of seats in the Senate, and the Senate voted to approve the proposal. But some Federalist members of the House of Representatives denounced it. They made many changes in the proposal. The Senate refused to accept the changes. Without agreement by both houses of Congress, the bill died. Federalist leaders saw their hopes for an election victory begin to disappear. By the summer of 1800, Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party had strong leaders in every state. It had many newspapers to express party ideas. Jefferson decided to take a holiday at Monticello, his farm in Virginia. The Republican Party leader in New York was a lawyer, Aaron Burr. Burr had served as an officer under General George Washington during America's War for Independence from Britain. After the war, he joined the Federalist Party and was elected to the United States Senate. Later, he changed parties and became a Republican. In 1800, a group of both Federalists and Republicans supported him as a candidate for president. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton were bitter enemies. When Hamilton learned of his own party's support for electing Burr, his reaction was quick and sharp. "Anybody," he said, "even Thomas Jefferson, is better than Aaron Burr. Jefferson is not dangerous. Burr is. Jefferson's ideas of government are wrong, but at least he is an honest man. Burr is a man without honesty and character. He will destroy America," Hamilton said. The president elected in 1800 would govern from a new capital city. The national government would move from Philadelphia to Washington, a newly built city in the District of Columbia. It was along the Potomac River between the states of Maryland and Virginia. When President Adams and his wife Abigail arrived in Washington, they found a frontier town. There were few houses or streets. Mrs. Adams could not believe what she saw. She wrote to her daughter, "This is a city only because we call it a city. Our house here is very big, but the rooms are not finished. There is almost no furniture. There are not enough lamps for light." John Adams also wrote to his wife about the house where the president would live. In a letter, he asked heaven to bless the house and whoever lived in it. A later president asked for Adams' blessing to be carved above a fireplace.
There is a mantle there with an inscription from John Adams saying, "May all future residents of this house be virtuous creatures."
Joseph Ellis is a historian and the author of many books about America's founding fathers. He says John Adams' words can still be found in the White House today. A street called Pennsylvania Avenue went from the president's house to the Capitol building where Congress would meet. On each side of the street, where buildings stand today, there were fields of mud. This was the new federal city, the new capital of the United States. This was where the winner of the presidential election of 1800 would begin his term of office. John Ferling taught American history at the University of West Georgia. He says Jefferson's party campaigned better and listened to the concerns of ordinary people.
The Republicans, the Jeffersonians, understood the American political process, the more democratic process that was coming into being, better than the Federalists did, and it enabled them to win a couple of key states, and that spelled doom for Adams.
George Washington won America's first two presidential elections without opposition. John Adams won the third presidential election by 3 electoral votes. This time, in 1800, there was no clear winner. When the electors' votes were counted, President Adams had 65 votes. But Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each had 73 votes. So under the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to choose between Jefferson and Burr, the candidates with the highest number of votes. Each congressman could vote, but each state had just one vote. That vote would go to the candidate supported by a majority of congressmen from the state. A candidate had to receive a majority of the state votes to win. In 1800, that meant 9 of the 16 states. The Federalists saw the situation as their last chance to control the presidency. They had two plans. They would try to block the Congress from electing either Jefferson or Burr as president. Then they would try to find a way to put executive power in the hands of a Federalist. If that plan failed, they were prepared to elect Burr. The Federalists tried to make people believe that Burr was working with them against Jefferson. Burr denied this. In a letter to Jefferson, Burr wrote, "Every Republican wants you to be president of the United States. Every good Republican wants to serve under you. I would be happy and honored to be your vice president. And if you believe I could help you better in some other position, I would do so." On February 11th, the House of Representatives began to count votes state by state. 8 states chose Jefferson. 6 chose Burr. The representatives of 2 states, Maryland and Vermont, gave each man an equal number of votes. There was no majority within those states, so neither man won the votes of those states. The voting continued. All that day and throughout the night, the representatives voted. 27 times, the count remained the same. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, 2 undecided. The next morning, the representatives decided to rest for 4 hours. The voting began again at noon. There was no change. The 13th of February passed, then the 14th and 15th. Still no change. The House voted 33 times. It could not elect a president. A change in the vote of just one congressman from Maryland or Vermont could decide the contest. Later, after the election, the representative from Delaware said he had met with 2 congressmen from Maryland and 1 from Vermont. All were Federalists. All had voted for Aaron Burr. The Delaware congressman said they claimed they spoke with a friend of Thomas Jefferson. He said they told Jefferson's friend they would change their votes if Jefferson made certain promises. Jefferson denied that he had made any political promises. He said many men tried to get promises from him, but he said he told all of them that he would never become president with his hands tied. The House of Representatives voted for the 36th time on February 17th. 10 states, including Maryland and Vermont, voted for Thomas Jefferson. 4 states voted for Aaron Burr. 2 states, Delaware and South Carolina, did not vote. But Jefferson had the majority he needed.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.